Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the fastest growing segment of our society. To those of you like me who know that there's something dreadfully wrong, even destructive, about religious and political institutions, media reporting, military invasions, and economic schemes. We realize that these institutions cause the problems that we're enduring, and therefore they are not the solution. So instead of merely presenting the news, our mission this morning and every day on this program is to understand who is causing these tragedies that are besieging our planet, why they're doing so, all while predicting how these events will influence our world. And that is why, typically in our second hour, today it'll be in our first, because we'll have the opportunity today to speak with IQ Al-Rasuli, and this is an extraordinarily important day to do that, based upon the news that is coming out of Europe relative to Syria. So today, in our first hour, so we can talk with IQ in our second, we're going to turn to the lone source of hope in this world. It's no longer politics. We're not going to prevail by reshuffling the deck chairs on this sinking vessel. You know, it doesn't matter how many Republicans or Democrats are elected. Not going to make any difference whatsoever. What we need to do is to recognize that there's only one dependable voice in our world. And that voice can be found in the Torah, a book that 99.9% of the world rejects. But it's the foundation. It is the constitution of life. And so we're going to consider what God has to say in it, because His covenant is the only way to form a relationship with Him. He wields His words wisely, and He provides answers for everything that ails us, no matter if it's economic ruin or terrorism, no matter if it's religious myths or political hypocrisy. Now, our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, and we had a lively one throughout the program yesterday, is 877-300-7645. In our review of the Genesis account, we had made our way to God's depiction of the conditions that existed in the Garden of Great Joy, Gan Eden. And we find that in the midst of that garden, God planted a tree. Actually, two. Well, He planted every tree in the garden, and He says all the trees in the garden were great to look at, beautiful, they were good. There was a tree of lives in the garden. Now, lives was important. It was in the plural, and we examined all the reasons why it was written the tree of lives. And then there was the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. And we learned that da'at, the Hebrew word for knowledge here, was knowledge based upon examining evidence. It's observation that leads to consideration that then manifests itself as understanding. And it was the knowledge of good and bad that we found in that particular tree. And the reason that this distinction is important is because God has already told us that His garden was filled with everything imaginable that was good. So the only thing that made this particular tree unique is it also provided access to the knowledge of that which was not good. And so we began to explore why it is that God would have to put something inside the garden that gave Adam and later Chawa the opportunity to understand that which is bad, malignant, counterproductive, lifeless. And what we realize is that the only reason that it can exist and that it had to exist was because of free will. The purpose of God to create the entire universe is the covenant, a family relationship. And to engage in a family relationship, to choose to love God as our Father and embrace Him for who He actually is, you have to have choice. If God did not give us the choice to reject Him, then this whole thing would be a fraud. It would be not unlike Larry, my friend in Florida, making a tape recorder with his own hands, and then recording a tape on that, and maybe even put it inside of a robot, so that it 24/7 plays, "Larry, you're the greatest," and then routinely goes over and gives Larry a big hug, gets down on its knees and bows down to Larry and says, "Oh, Larry, you are just the best." And it does it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. That's what we would be if we did not have choice.
And every now and then he does something bad to Larry, just to teach him.
Just
so he knows.
Just to smack him one?
Hello, Larry. So Larry knows.
Hello, Larry. How are you this morning?
Yeah, I had to get rid of that robot. It drove me crazy.
Yeah, and that is exactly what the life in the Garden of Eden would have been like between Adam and God, between Adam and Yahweh, had the choice to reject God not existed in that garden. It's so simple, so profound. It's amazing that people don't understand it. And then we spent 2 days, and I think particularly 2 days ago, as we devoted an entire program to why God can't micromanage the world, why the whole Christian mythos is you pray to God for your spouse, you pray to God for your job, you pray to God for to get the touchdown in the football game, that you pray to God to heal your child of some disease, that the moment God begins to micromanage and engage in such affairs, then he ceases to be honest as it relates to the prime directive. And the prime directive, the only reason the universe exists is for the covenant. And the covenant cannot exist if God micromanages and interferes in free will.
I think I've said this before. You'd call the tree of good and evil, you could call it the tree of choice. Because,
yes,
you know, this is what gives... This is why we have choice. I mean,
right. And what really is the difference between the tree of understanding good and bad and the tree of choice? I mean, isn't choice, at least any choice that has merit, is based on understanding. The moment you make a choice about something you don't understand, then that's more like a reaction than it is a choice, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you could also say it'd be like taking a person and putting them in a cage, too, even though it was a comfortable cage.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Not letting them know anybody else and just saying, here, you're going to have a relationship with me, and maybe you raise a small child up that way. Maybe that would be the better analogy.
Yeah, it would be like us, if we were creative, being able to create a chimpanzee that would play nice all the time, that wouldn't tear our nose or eyeballs out or eat our fingers, that sort of thing. We could have in a cage, and we would have, you know, in our home, we would have a special part of our home that was a cage, and we say, okay, this is chimpanzee land. We're going to have all sorts of great bananas here in chimpanzee land, and lots of ropes and toys to swing on. And when I choose to go in there, you know, the chimp and I, we're going to be buds, but the chimp is not going to experience anything that's outside of this cage. That's what it would have been like. Yeah, really nice cage, really nice zookeeper, but is that worth creating the universe?
No, Yahweh wanted to be chosen. That's the whole point. That's what he wants now. He wants us to choose.
Right.
That's it.
So we were, in yesterday's program, we were beginning to talk about the times that God did intervene. Because it's his universe. He has every right to intervene when he chooses to. And he, at some occasions, actually has to intervene to be reliable, to be truthful, to be who he really is. So he made a promise, for example, to Abraham, that his descendants would ultimately be reconciled in the covenant relationship and would receive its blessings. And if they were remain slaves in Egypt, and he even told them they were going to be slaves in Egypt, but he told them that he would bring them back home. If he did not intervene and bring them out of Egypt, then he would have been a liar. He would have negated the purpose of the covenant. He was in a situation with Yehuda after Yisrael, the northern kingdom, had fallen to the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and 10 of the 12 tribes had been hauled away into captivity. He was in a situation with Hezekiah, where Hezekiah found a copy of the Torah, realized, we've been ignoring this. We've been trying to form, like the President of the United States right now, trying to form alliances to beat back that big bad enemy over there, the boogeyman. And all the while, this is a document that tells us all we have to do is rely on Yahweh, and he will be our shield. And so Hezekiah says, okay, to heck with all of those foreign treaties. Let's engage in Passover. That Passover is the doorway to life. Let's do Passover, and we're going to live. And, you know, he got rid of all of the religious paraphernalia all over Yehuda.
Took Easter vestiges.
All of that. All of the sun god stuff that has morphed into Easter and Christmas, Sunday worship, all of that sort of thing. He got rid of it all. And they celebrated Pesach, although they were a couple of weeks late. God said, you know, the timing is a lot less important than the attitude here. You know, so no problem being a little late here. Going to go along with that. And what happened? God intervened. He saw to it that the water outside of the city walls
was septic.
Became septic. And so when the army drank, they all died.
I think it killed, 180,000 of them.
Yeah, And we know, we have verification. I mean, it sounds like a tall tale, right? You know, you've got the mightiest army on earth surrounding what at the time was a small town without any means to defend itself and without any allies after having eliminated every town in the northern kingdom and every city in the northern kingdom. And we have proof that this happened because there's not only can we trust Yah's word, but there's pilasters in Assyria, Babylon, Iraq, Iran, that have been unearthed that say, here I am. I was the king at the time. I tried to get them. They were like a bird in a cage. But I came back home because I couldn't do it. And so we have verification. So he did intervene then. Why did he intervene? Because the promise of Passover is forever with God. We'll return in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about God's intervention into human affairs and when he has done it and why he doesn't do it routinely. I would say that the most important ramification that where we find a limiting of God's involvement in human affairs, where God is unwilling to suppress free will as it pertains to his testimony. The first sin recorded in Yahweh's word is the corruption of his words. Satan and Chawa both misquoted and manipulated Yahweh's instructions. And since God obviously allowed this, and read the first instance of sin, of corruption, in the Torah. It's Yahweh allowing HaSatan, the adversary, to slither into the garden. He had to allow him in. And then once there, he allowed him to present a corruption, a twisting of his testimony, and he allowed Chawa to misquote him. And between the two, to come to an entirely different conclusion than what God had conveyed. God allowed it, didn't he? And if he allowed that corruption of his testimony there, if he allowed HaSatan to influence the woman then and there in the garden, why is it that religious aficionados think that when they hold up their English Bible, that it's the inerrant word of God, that God, I kept this absolutely perfect. God would never allow anyone to corrupt his word. Well, that's exactly the opposite of what you read in the first story of its kind in the Torah.
Not only that, I was absolutely amazed to find out how inaccurate, you know, English Bibles are. They're just horrid.
They're horrid. Yeah, if you're looking at the Hebrew, the difference between the Masoretic and the Qumran scrolls is about one word in every 14 or so, and many of those errors are fairly minor. In terms of significant issues, it's probably one word in every 50. But unfortunately, the translations are a bigger issue. And sometimes what we have not translations at all, but copy edits and replacements. The greatest example would be the names, in particular God's name, Yahweh. It's changed 7,000 times in your English Bible. It's Yahweh. It's never the Lord. And so you start there and you say, all right, well, then you have to go beyond that and to say that many of the most important words are misrepresented.
Like Kodesh is turned to holy.
Right, and it means set apart. And set apart is an extraordinarily important concept. You can't understand God. You can't understand the covenant. You can't understand anything that he said, including who Yahusha is, until you come to understand the concept of set apart. And when it's corrupted and changed to holy, that understanding is lost, and with that understanding, so is the knowledge of who God is and how we can approach him. There are many, many, if not even most, Hebrew words that are misrepresented in English translations.
I was amazed to see actual DSS breakdowns, as you know, opposed to what we find in modern religious material, and they don't read anything alike. They come to different conclusions. They do not say the same things. Yeah. I mean, some of them, and it's little wonder that Christians don't want to look at Yahweh's words, because it's so convoluted and screwed up in the religious material, it doesn't even make sense.
Well, some of it doesn't make sense because the way that it's been. Yeah. Yeah, like, for example, Yom Kippurim. If you read an English translation of the Day of Reconciliations, which the Christian Bible will call it the Day of Atonement, you will find God asking man to debase, to rape and pillage his own soul, and that's the way that you are reconciled into your relationship with God.
Sounds like something Satan would enjoy.
Exactly. And if you look then at the Hebrew, it's rather than asking you to deny yourself or to debase yourself, in the actual Hebrew, it says, answer the invitation and come into the presence of the maternal aspect of Yah's light. That's what it asks us to do.
How about third statement where he tells us not to attach his name or reputation to anything to do with religion, and it becomes not take the Lord's name in vain.
The third statement, as it's reported in English Bibles, is senseless. When it's considered in the Hebrew, it's brilliant. There's so many examples of that, and that's the good part. The bad news is the so-called Christian New Testament. Welcome back to Shattering Inside Yada. We have Larry here. We're talking about God's intervention into human affairs and the fact that he does not micromanage, because that would destroy the prime directive, which is to establish the covenant relationship as a family-oriented relationship. And so we were talking about maintaining without corruption his testimony. And we made it very clear that God said that he's not about to do that. He allowed Satan into the garden, allowed Satan to twist his words, allowed Chawa, mankind in the sense of humankind, to twist his words. And what we find in the evidence is that there is a substantial difference between the Qumran scrolls and the Masoretic. As a matter of fact, there is no such thing as just a Masoretic text. Today we rely mostly on the Codex Leningradus. It was supposedly written sometime in the 11th century. We didn't find it until the 18th century and didn't make it available to anyone until the 19th century. So our English Bibles, the so-called Old Testament, which is a corrupted name, were not based upon the Masoretic as we know it. They, not at all. In fact, the difference between the second oldest Masoretic text, the one that was actually available in the 16th and 17th centuries, is, I mean, they differ so dramatically as to not even be comparable. And then you have this this issue that even the Qumran scrolls differ among themselves. And again, you don't have, there's no monolithic Masoretic text. And the realization is that the so-called Old Testament was actually put together based upon the Greek Septuagint translation.
Yeah, so, which makes no sense. Why would you take an original and then it goes into another language, from that language you put it into another language?
For several reasons. One is that rabbis, being so influenced by Babylon, came to prefer Aramaic to Hebrew. And they lost their skill in Hebrew and became dependent on Aramaic. And they found out that with their Aramaic translation of the Torah, it didn't have to be a translation because the people themselves couldn't read Hebrew anymore after a while. And so they could create their own variation that served their interest, and they did. So their Aramaic translation was no longer a translation, but a paraphrase to serve their religious interests. Now, as it relates to the Septuagint, you've got two issues with the Septuagint, and it's important that people recognize this so that they know that if they're reading their English Bible, not only is the name on the cover wrong, God did not name his testimony after an Egyptian sun goddess, Biblia, but the contents are wrong. And that there is no example of a text you can say, well, this one's perfect and all the rest are bogus, and let's go to that one and make the translation out of that one. You've got to really work to try to come to the truth. That's exactly the way that God wants it, by the way. And so you look at the Septuagint. By the time that Jerome, who had the most influence ever on any of this, he wrote the compiled the Latin Vulgate, which was in the 4th century a duty on behalf of his pope, and he didn't do it so that people could know the truth. He did it because there were so many variations that the religious institution knew that with many variations the people would have questions, and the only way to effectively establish a dominant institution was to say, we alone have the true copy. And so they hired Jerome to create that one true copy. And the way that he did it is that he was not a Hebrew scholar, didn't even speak Hebrew. So he took the Septuagint and he translated the Greek translation of the Hebrew into Latin. And then from the Latin, most of our English Bibles, as a matter of fact, almost everything that emerged in English was a translation of the Latin.
Yeah, so it's just a blend of the Septuagint and the Latin Vulgate. That's
right. Now, and you have a problem with the Septuagint. And that is that by the 3rd century, in fact, even by the 2nd century of this era, the Septuagint had become so corrupt that variations of it were so far afield from one another that Origen devoted most of his life to creating what he called the Hexapla, which was he had five columns where he was trying to compare the Hebrew to the most popular copies of the Septuagint, and finally creating this final column over here of a Greek translation that was a blend of these, and he was going to call the blend, all right, this is the best I can do. But unfortunately, his Hexapla was lost to time. And so all we have is whichever copy you chose to use, it was riddled with errors. And now that's the good part. The bad part is the so-called Christian New Testament. Again, a bogus name. The covenant has not been renewed, so there cannot be a New Testament. God will renew his covenant. He has not done so yet. So the very concept of a New Testament is completely errant. But beyond that, that we have unearthed almost exclusively in the sands of Egypt 69 copies of 69 codexes, if you will, some as small as a postage stamp fragment, others as large as, if you were to take a quarter of the of what you find in the text of the so-called Christian New Testament, you might find a quarter of it available in one codex or a binding of pages together, of papyrus pages together.
Yeah, there's 69
total that predate Constantine. And the reason we look at the 69 that predate Constantine is because once Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the land and created the institution that we know today as the Roman Catholic Church, that from that point on, there is absolutely no textual integrity. At that point on, the church thought that it was their purview to change anything they wished to change, and they added, they subtracted, and they edited as they saw fit. And so from the formation of the Roman Catholic Church in the mid-4th century on, the textual fidelity is just out the door, out the window. I mean, it's a, you might as well just throw the words up in a tornado and see where they land.
And one other thing that should be pointed out here, because you get a lot of people that buy into the myth that their Aramaic religious book is somehow better, but they need to understand that the Aramaic is just a copy back into Aramaic off the Latin. It's not an original.
Correct. Or either that or off of the Greek. But the fact of the matter is that the first extant copy of an Aramaic translation dates to the 6th century, and by that time there are tens of thousands of codexes and fragments in Greek that precede it. So if you have tens of thousands in one language, and then the first one in this other language appears in the that can be dated to the 6th century, you've got zero chance that the anomaly is the genuine article, or that it is closer to the truth.
We know for a fact it's not, because the same copy edits that we saw thrown into the Textus Receptus as an example,
right,
or in the 8th century when they did a complete overhaul, those same mistakes, those same
correct
add-ons, those same copy
correct
edits are found in the Aramaic books. So they're literally
yes
being copied off of, you
right
know, I
yeah
think.
Right. And then you have the, and I want particularly Christians that are listening to this program who think that they're reading their Christian New Testament and they're reading the Word of God. I want them to have a firm grasp on reality here. And we're not sharing our opinion here. This is irrefutable fact. There are 300,000 known variants between those 69 first, second, and third century manuscripts, and the basis of English translations today, whether you look at the Nestle Allen or the Textus Receptus. 300,000 known variants over the so-called words of the Christian New Testament. There's only 182,000 words, depending on which variation you use, and yet there are more variants than there are words. So when you're reading it, the basis of it isn't even remotely accurate. And then you have the problem of before I even get to Paul's letters, you have all the problems of that even in Greek, it was a translation of what was said. No one spoke Greek other than Paul. Let's put Paul aside for a moment. Yosha never had a conversation in Greek, never once. And so when you're reading his words in English, they're translated twice over, losing something along the way both times. Now, beyond that, you've got the realization of translation error. And while about 20 to 25% of the text just does not mesh with the oldest manuscripts, and about 25% of the text is corrupted because we have dual translation. You've got about 25% where the word is just wrongly translated. Absolutely wrong. Virtually every name. Oh, they get the names right of the bad folks. They just don't get the names right of Yahweh, Yahusha, Masayah.
Matanyahu, Yahu Kanan.
They don't get any of the names right. If you don't get the names right, you don't know who you're talking to. You don't know whose message it is that you're considering. You have zero chance of knowing who Yahusha is if you don't know his name. None. And so you've got all of those issues. And then on top of that, you've got the fact that half of the so-called Christian New Testament was written by a guy who admitted to being demon-possessed, who admitted to being insane, who admitted to being a sexual pervert, who admitted to being murderous, whose every word served to contradict Yahweh's testimony in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and to undermine the words and deeds of Yahusha. Half of it is written by a man who admitted to being demon-possessed, read 2 Corinthians, a man who admitted that he was insane, a man who admitted that he was a sexual pervert, read Romans 7,
a man who called the Torah, what was it, pornography?
Pornography, yeah. The basis of the English word pornography, poneros, in Greek. He called the Torah pornography. Said that it was filled with religious mythology. Said that it was enslaving. Said that the God who spoke it was impotent. That it was incapable of doing anything that would be productive. Welcome back to Shattering This. We have Jason, who is called in from Toronto, who would like to lighten the mood for us a bit. Although, you know, I think this particular the story that we're talking about right now in terms of the lack of dependability of the so-called Christian New Testament is something that really ought to lighten the mood, because if you once you come to embrace that, then you're in a position where you can say, well, where can I go to find answers? And you end up doing, Jason, what you have chosen to do, which is to study the Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's actually a big relief to not have to look at the New Testament as inerrant.
Yeah, it is. It's huge, because once you get rid of Paul, and then you get rid of the all the bogus names and misstatements, all of a sudden, wow, there's no more conflicts. This is one cohesive story. It makes perfect sense. It's liberating. It's enlightening. It's uplifting. And you're not doing mental gymnastics trying to justify obvious contradictions.
Yeah, just, throwing out Paul is the single best thing a person can do if they're trying to understand, you know, the Yah's revelation.
Yep. Yeah. So I understand you had a story you wanted to tell us.
Yeah, well, I always enjoy a good Paul dashing on the program. And,
okay.
That was the other day, and it never seems to be unproductive. You know, sometimes when you're going down a road that maybe doesn't lead anywhere, you get sort of sense of that. But
right.
I never get weary of bashing Paul, or, you know, finding ways to point out his the problems with his letters and whatnot.
Besides pointing out,
I had a joke about Paul.
Oh, go ahead, please.
Please.
Knock. All right. Who's there?
Well, that depends. Are you a Jew or a Gentile? do you observe the Torah or don't?
Let me guess.
Yeah. What Jason is alluding to here is that Paul admitted to every one of his foibles. I mean, Paul laid himself out on the table and said, you are so stupid, you're going to choose to believe me even if I tell you that I'm not believable. And one of the things that Paul did is he went through and he says, you know, to the Jew, I pretend to be a Jew. To the Gentile, I'm a Gentile. To those who observe the Torah, I pretend to observe the Torah, even though I really don't. And to those who do not observe the Torah, I am, of course, Torahless. To each, I take advantage of the opportunity to be who they want me to be, so that I can win them. And so,
well, God have around.
You know, Machiavelli, Machiavelli has a bad name because, he wrote some bad stuff. But Machiavelli's primary thesis is he was writing to fellow wealthy Italians about how they should abuse their power over the being popes in the Roman Catholic Church. And what he decided was, you know, if you're scary enough and mean enough and threatening enough and belligerent enough, that the people will ultimately obey you. And so what Machiavelli wrote is that the ends justify the means. So it doesn't matter what means you use so long as you end up at the right place, or at least the place that you that empowers you. And that's basically what Paul said. You know, it doesn't matter what's true. Truth is irrelevant to me. I will pretend to be whatever suits my interests in terms of prevailing and persuading you.
You know, what's really wild about that, I remember sitting in churches and the preacher saying, Paul has said, I've become all things to all men. You know, they were quoting it like it was a wow.
Yeah. And they actually speak of that and do sermons on it as if, well, Paul wrote scripture, therefore this must be a godly concept. Now imagine that. The God who created the universe needs to lie, needs to come across as a phony for you to believe him. Now, you can imagine that. I mean, how utterly moronic do you have to be to know that the Creator God of the universe doesn't have to fool you to please you?
Well, yeah, you know, I know of nobody that actually spoke for Yahweh or wrote for Yahweh that said, I lie to do so. None.
That's a good point, because there's also the, I'm not sure if it was Zephaniah or one of the minor prophets, when Yahweh said he actually, speaking to the Levites or the mm-hmm. Kohen, or the Lowi, sorry, of the Kohen, and he said that, that they have a respect for
persons. Jason, I think we're out of time, unfortunately. We only have about 10 seconds left in this segment. So we're going to return after the break. Hopefully we'll hear from IQ Al-Rasuli, and we'll change the topic to the war in Syria.